From the Partnership for Public Service, you're listening to Transition Lab, a behind-the-scenes look at presidential transitions. I'm David Marchik. Today, we have Jonathan McBride and Liza Wright as our guests. They each worked for many years in the Office of Presidential Personnel, one of the most powerful offices in the country, and both of them eventually became the director of that office. As Ronald Reagan famously said, personnel is policy, and the Office of Presidential Personnel places more than 4,000 people across the government for a new president, and almost half as many for a re-elected president. Jonathan worked for Obama's Presidential Personnel Office from 2009 to 2014, and until recently served as Global Head of Diversity and Inclusion at BlackRock. Liza served in George W. Bush's Presidential Personnel Office from 2003 to 2007, and is currently a managing partner at Lachlan Partners, where she focuses on executive search and recruitment. Jonathan and Liza, thanks for being here today.
Thank you for having us.
So start off with an easy one. For those of you, for those of our listeners who don't know what it is, what is PPO, or the Office of Presidential Personnel? Do you want to start that, Liza?
Sure. So the Office of Presidential Personnel is essentially the office that helps to identify and select all of the appointees that are politically appointed by the president. And what a lot of people don't realize is when a president comes into office, they have, you know, over 4,000 positions that they can place, ranging from cabinet secretaries, you know, to, you know, more junior level positions, staff assistants, to basically staff kind of all the agencies and departments to carry out their agenda. And so in essence, the office that Jonathan and I led kind of was the office that kind of carried out the management of all of those appointments across the administration.
So 4,000 people, that's a lot. That's a huge operation. It's basically the largest takeover of any entity in the world when there's a new president. Jonathan, how big an office is PPO and how many people worked there when you led it?
Well, it varies. We had just over 50 people working kind of full-time in our personnel office, but we also had people distributed throughout the agencies called White House liaisons that we hired. They just didn't work in the personnel office. So by comparison, we hired about as many people per year as my former employer, BlackRock, did. Their HR department is over 400 people. We were about 53.
So that's a lot of work for a small group. And what type of people do you try to recruit?
I think this is an interesting question. You know, regardless of who you talk to from administration to administration, you're going to get a kind of a varying degree of answers. And also, I think the team in the beginning of an administration kind of evolves as, you know, through the transition, because that's obviously a huge time where the volume is so heavy that we usually have to staff up the presidential personnel operation in that first year to be able to accommodate all the recruitment that needs to go on. But in essence, what we looked for are, you know, folks that first and foremost support the president and his agenda, but also really looking at, you know, people who understood how to select and assess talent. And I think I'd be curious, Jonathan, that I don't know how that varied from administration to administration, but I know in the Bush White House, they were looking for somebody that had a search background. So that's why they brought me in. I did not have a political background. And so one of the things I tried to do was to pull more people that had search backgrounds so that we could help, you know, train the team on how to, you know, the best practices of how do you go out and recruit proactively? How do you assess talent? So it's kind of a nice, you know, balance between the political background, the substantive background of kind of the issue areas that they're recruiting in, and then having the recruitment background.
Yeah. So, and I knew that about you and your team. We started off almost entirely people from the campaign. If I remember correctly, actually, I was the first non-campaign person hired into the personnel office, and I came in August. But they were people who were highly skilled in certain areas, so they had subject matter expertise in the policy areas and had been doing stuff on the campaign related. But there were not people from a search background. And I had been working as a consultant to large companies, but I was kind of like the first person to come in with a background of sorts for that. I think over time, we started to look for more people who had those types of backgrounds, but we still actually candidly still had people who were more policy experts than they were talent experts.
So is it typical that early in administration, the Office of Presidential Personnel might have someone from the campaign or someone close to the candidate that runs it, and then over time, they bring in more professional search or more, you know, professional HR type people?
I think that's certainly what our experience in the Bush administration was. Clay Johnson was the first head of presidential personnel, followed by Dina Powell. And, you know, Clay was just a very close personal friend, an accomplished, you know, business executive as well. But, you know, he came in and really got everything kind of up and running. And I think then, you know, after about a year and a half, 2 years, you know, I think they saw a need to bring in someone that had that kind of search background. When Dina was elevated to be the head of presidential personnel, I came in as her deputy. And we made kind of I think we balanced the skill sets that she had and that I had, I think made a good combination.
That's interesting. Like literally, our story is very similar. Don Gipps was very close with the president and had been working with him for quite some time, and a friend of his and an ally. He was replaced by a woman promoted internally, Nancy Hogan, who became my boss because I came in as her deputy and as the first person with kind of more recruitment and retention or kind of development skill set. So it's actually a very, very similar pattern in that regard.
So both of you have professional business and HR experience, search experience. What surprised you from your private sector experience going into recruiting for the government? What were the biggest surprises?
I mean, the first for me was the idea that on January 20th, somebody blows a whistle and everybody from the CEO to three levels down leaves an agency. And right. then a new CEO comes in and you replace them. I think that was significant. And I think if you haven't come out of the political campaign world, the politics of all the people and all the constituencies and all the interests at first are pretty significant. And while there are small p politics in business, it is nothing like the various vectors and then the media scrutiny that you get at a job like this. So that was those two things were pretty surprising. But the main thing is how few people pay their taxes.
Yeah.
I didn't know.
Yeah, that's pretty funny. I would say the exact same thing on the nanny tax issue kind of plagued us a lot. But I will also echo what Jonathan was saying about, I mean, really, it's like in the private sector, you know, a lot of companies are constantly doing, you know, they're doing succession planning, right? But when what Jonathan described is by the time you are placing the first round of people, it's not too much longer later that you've got to start thinking about, you know, the succession planning exercise all over again. So I think that was definitely a surprise.
And is 50 the right number? If you had to design this on your own, would you say you should have 100 or 150? What's the right number of people to actually do a good job in presidential personnel?
When I was there, it was post-transition because I came in March of 2003. I will say during the 2004 election, you know, it's nothing like kind of the first term, but when it's a second term, you know, we definitely staffed up. We, you know, replaced 8 or 9 cabinet members and that kind of carried a lot of volume, you know, but I think at the end of the day, our numbers varied, you know, maybe 50 in the beginning, you know, when I was there, it ebbed and flowed between like 25 and 30 to 35 within the actual Office of Presidential Personnel. I think if you had asked any one of the special assistants that reported to me, they would tell you that they felt pretty overloaded most of the time.
Right.
Yeah. So I do think that, you know, it was a budget issue, you know, and I do think that, you know, more probably 50 more consistently during the non-transition times is probably a good number.
Yeah. And one thing I'd say, Dave, just to make the point, is that number of 50 or so is also without a budget to hire people like Liza. So in a corporate setting, you also are bringing in specialists who are helping you in executive search fill some of your trickiest positions. You do not have a budget for that in federal government. So you're 50 people really doing all of the work, including the vetting and everything else. So it's a pretty significant workload. I don't know what the right number is. Bigger than 50 would be good, But in particular, I think if you want to be able to search the whole country and find non-traditional candidates and convince them to come in and serve their government, so you have a bunch of new faces as well as people who've done this before, you need a broader reach and you have to come up with ways to do it. And it's hard to do that with 50 people.
So you're all doing well in the private sector. You're very successful. You get a call from the White House that says, we want you to serve, and you go into the White House to get this job. Did all of a sudden friends come out of the woodwork, people you went to kindergarten with, people you hadn't heard from, and said, hey, you remember me? Can I have a job in the White House? Like, how did that work?
Well, a lot of people, it's interesting, Dave, because a lot of people would say to me, wow, you're the head of presidential personnel. You're pretty popular. And I would say the exact opposite.
Yes, exactly.
Because at the end of the day, there's for every one position, there could be 20, 30 plus candidates that all want the job and that are kind of vying for the job. You're getting lobbied by members of Congress, by governors, by folks in the private sector, by folks within the White House, folks within, the agencies sometimes, are not always in agreement and they're lobbying their own folks. So you've got to be kind of the person that has kind of, okay, here's my mission to find the very best people to serve this president who are the most qualified and who are here to serve something greater than themselves. And that is the most kind of critical thing that I tried to really hone in with my team. That's what we're looking for and try to kind of take some of the noise out of the equation. But it's not always easy to do in such a highly political environment.
Well, how about you, Jonathan? Did all of a sudden you become more popular and funnier, taller, better shape? People thought you were really cool once you worked in the White House and you heard from people that didn't call you before?
Dave, for the record, people think I'm cool, but
okay.
Just kidding. No, I would say Liza is exactly right. You are delivering way more disappointment than you are happiness in a job like this. And there's an added element because we put people through a rather rigorous vetting process. And there are plenty of times when you have to call somebody up and explain that they're not going forward in the process, but you can't tell them why. Because the FBI, IRS, all these people are involved. And that obviously makes them very nervous. And so it leads to a lot of very uncomfortable situations. And people, I still run into people periodically at parties and things like that. And they kind of like move away from me because they're like, they think that I know something about them. But it is really difficult. And I think it's particularly hard on two levels for some of the younger staff who are less experienced at it. One, they get attached to people and candidates. And so it's hard to disappoint them. And two, because they're working so much and so rigorously, they can't always give each candidate the attention they would love to give them. And that can become sometimes hard for them.
Right. I mean, when I was in the government, people always complained about presidential personnel. They said they never return my calls. They're not responsive, et cetera. So I always thought, I wish they would return my calls faster. But I'm sure when you were head of presidential personnel, you must have received 400 or 500 phone calls and emails a day. I mean, do you remember how much incoming you had and what was your capacity to handle the incoming?
It was measured in the hundreds. And, I had a fantastic staff assistant that helped me to kind of cull through that. And I would return kind of the higher priority ones and then just try to delegate the other ones to other members of the team. But it was hundreds of inputs. And, there were people, because at any given time we're recruiting, for not just, 10 or 20 positions, but, hundreds of positions. And, folks often made the mistake of getting people to kind of campaign for them. And I'd get 10 or 20 calls about one person. And, so that's the kind of stuff that, we dealt with.
Well, let's drill down on that a little, because this will be interesting for our listeners. So we have an election coming up. Either Donald Trump will be reelected November 3rd or Joe Biden will be our president. And so let's say that you're working on one of those campaigns or that you're a big supporter of one of the two candidates and you want to get a job post-election. What's the best way to approach presidential personnel and what's the absolute worst way? So Jonathan, do you want to take that one first?
Well, to put it in a frame of reference, in the couple of days after the election in 2008, 253,000 people submitted resumes into the resume database. That's not including people who had already been submitting during the campaign. And, if you went through those 253,000, you found CEOs of publicly traded companies who didn't know what to do. So they just went to the website and put their resume in. So it's overwhelming. It's not to say don't do that. We searched that database for 8 years, search it the whole time. And so being in the database is particularly important. But, you know, people who've worked on the campaign and built relationships and have had some visibility and are known to be expert on something, that's a great way to be connected in. And making sure you're raising your hand through whatever connections you have to the White House is also a good thing. But there are lots of different groups, trade groups, community organizations, philanthropies who start putting together lists of people who care about their topics and their issue areas. So we leveraged tons of outside groups to help us get people from all over the country. And it was a very effective mechanism.
So you want to get your resume in. You want to try to call or register your interest with the personnel office. And then maybe you want to get on a list from some outside group or advocate for women or for national security or for environmental issues or some group that is engaged with the particular candidate.
Yeah. And I would also visit the Partnership for Public Service site and find out about the things you can do in advance to prepare for the vetting process at different levels. And one of the only things you can do to speed your process is to have done a lot of work ahead, especially for Senate confirmed jobs. Having the paperwork and information available saves a lot of time, because if you start that when you meet us, it adds a lot of time to your process.
That's a great plug, because in late July, we're going to have a website up called Ready to Serve, which will give step-by-step instructions on how to apply, what forms to fill out, what questions you might get, what kind of tax issues you need to anticipate. And the goal is to allow people to get ready for November 4th if they want to serve. Liza, let's go to the opposite. So Jonathan gave a very good answer on how you get a job. What was the most annoying or difficult approach that someone made to you when you were head of presidential personnel, and how did that backfire on that person?
Okay. I promise to come back to that, but I have one more thing if it's okay
please.
To add to what I can talk about this all day, to what Jonathan said. And that is, I always tell people to do your homework. I mean, one of the things when you're in presidential personnel and someone submits a resume, it's so helpful if someone has gone to this, kind of taken the steps to really research what positions in the government they're interested in, mm-hmm. and they believe they're qualified for. And so in your cover letter or your email or however you're submitting that information, make sure you're saying, hey, I have a really strong background in international trade, and I've identified these, you know, five positions as ones that I would be really interested in. I think the more they can kind of help, you know, help the process, because it's like, you know, it's like the floodgates open in the beginning of any administration, and the PPO office is overwhelmed, as Jonathan said. So that's first. As far as the worst, I mean, oh my goodness. I mean, there was one person that launched a campaign. I had literally 50 or 60 phone calls that were coming, and letters being faxed in, which is funny, the fax back then. But I think the most egregious situation that I was, that it, you used the word annoyed, and that struck a specific memory. One of my responsibilities, and Jonathan's too, was to handle the ambassadors. And I one time had a husband and wife that came into the office and tried to pitch me on the idea of being neighboring country ambassadors. And so basically they each wanted an ambassadorship in neighboring countries, and that they thought that was a great idea. So that, when I think about annoying, that, you know, it just shows kind of a lack of judgment, I think, in a lot of ways. But
what were those people's names?
No, we're not going to talk about that. That's where I draw the line. But okay. But I definitely think the no-no is to really start, you know, early in a process like launching a campaign. I don't know, Jonathan, if you...
But sometimes it's useful to have, if, let's say you're a candidate, and sometimes the White House will want to know, does this person have support in the Senate or the House?
Yes.
So you're saying demonstrate some level of support, but don't go overboard, and you need a Goldilocks approach to that. So not too much, not too little.
Yeah, Jonathan, you can definitely chime in on this. I would say yes. I mean, there are times, what I always appreciated is when candidates would say to me, listen, I have a lot of support, and they would show me, they would say, here's a list of the folks that I know would be very supportive, especially if it were on Capitol Hill, that, you know, because that's certainly relevant. We would openly talk about it. And I, you know, I would let them know, you know, if and when I needed to speak to those people, or maybe if I wanted letters of recommendation. But to just have all these people start kind of berating the office with phone calls and things like that, I think is not a good approach.
So did someone ever say, I'm very close with this senator, and then you called that senator and that senator said, whatever you do, don't hire that person?
Yes. Okay. That happened. But also, I can't tell you how many times I would get a letter from a senator saying, I recommend this person. And then it was quickly followed up by a phone call from them to me saying, oh, by the way, I sent you this letter, but I kind of had to do that. I really wouldn't recommend them. I mean, I don't know if Jonathan, if you ever had that happen, but it was almost like they felt like they had to write the letter to say, okay, I'll do this. But then on the flip side, I was getting the backdoor kind of reference saying, you know, the senator doesn't really feel strongly about it, or something like that. So it was just a lot of craziness.
Yeah, there were people that were in a couple different categories. There were the people that they were sending, they wanted to prove that they put in the process, but they weren't feeling strongly about. There were people who they wanted us to call and engage, but it wasn't like, you know, a super strong support. It was more that they wanted the person to be considered. And then there were people they felt strongly about. And I would say the only thing I would add to what Liza was saying is that if you're giving a list of names is a great idea. That is exactly what you should do. But the other thing you need to think about is, are these people helping my candidacy? So if somebody can speak to the substance of what you can do or your acumen in some way or something like that, that's great. 20 people saying that they like you does not help. And it becomes a judgment question after a while, right? If you approach this way, when you're acting on behalf of the president of the United States, are you going to show similar poor judgment?
Are you going to give us any names of people that really annoyed you, Jonathan? Or
I'm not, but I'm going to tell you what one thing that actually I didn't love about the job, which was you would see every once in a while someone's worst version of themselves. So I remember vividly a guy who felt he was very important, and we were at an event, and he didn't know who I was, and I was in the crowd. He kept interrupting me and talking over me, and kept everybody else for that matter. And at some point, somebody walks up and asks me a question about how it was going, because I'd been in the office for probably about 4 or 5 months at that point. And when he heard what I did, he turned around and then followed me around all night, just paying so much warm attention to me, because suddenly he found out that I had the job. But prior to that, was treating me like everybody else in the room, which was just lesser. And unfortunately, every once in a while, you get one of those.
Okay, let me ask you another difficult question. So let's say you had the White House chief of staff or someone very important in the White House pushing you to hire someone. And let's say a cabinet officer was pushing a different person for that same role in their own agency. How do you handle that situation?
Oh, boy. You want to take that, Jonathan? I'm happy to start if you want.
Go ahead.
Okay. Well, first of all, I mean, I think you were using the chief of staff as just an example, because I never, ever had a situation where I had our chief of staff pushing me to hire someone. But I did have often situations where, you know, people in the White House who were in charge of, you know, the policy, having concerns about a candidate, you know, or wanting one particular candidate, and then the agency or department wanting a different person. Mm-hmm. And that is about as kind of one of the harder challenges that we have to walk a fine line. Our job is to find the best, most qualified people that support the president's agenda. And I think at the end of the day, we would try to sit down. I would sometimes have to mediate this and sit down and have an adult conversation about what is really best. And, you know, and thankfully, I can't remember too many times. There definitely were a few where, you know, we couldn't resolve it. And we had one particular cabinet member that would, you know, that went, you know, directly to the president when they didn't get what they wanted. And interestingly, the president ended up siding kind of with our judge on that. So we really tried to listen to all the inputs. But at the end of the day, and I'm sure Jonathan, you hopefully, I think, would agree with this, is that we needed the best candidate at the end of the day, not necessarily who the cabinet member, you know, thought was the best, because sometimes that wasn't always, you know, in alignment.
But presumably it's your job also to read the tea leaves, and not all cabinet officers are created equal. For example, we had Jim Baker on Transition Lab last week, and he basically said, when I was Secretary of State, I didn't even go to presidential personnel. I just picked who I wanted. Right. And that was the deal I cut with the president. So you knew which cabinet officer had more leeway, so to speak, than others, right?
That's right. So let me, I'll give you one other example. So when Hank Paulson came in as Treasury Secretary, you know, he kind of had, he had on the one hand that deal with the president, but he worked so beautifully and closely with our office. I mean, he used us almost as his, you know, as his executive search firm. And, you know, I was kind of lockstep with him on every position we hired. So I think, you know, I think where it gets, you know, we also, but on the flip side, we had a bit of an antagonistic relationship with DOD. Secretary.
And that was Rumsfeld when he was secretary, right?
Yeah, it was. Yeah. And when I came in as head of PPO, it was already a really sour relationship, mm-hmm. And I inherited, I walked in and it was not a good situation. When Gates came in, you know, we built a great relationship. And so right. A lot of things changed in terms of how we interacted with DOD. And so again, not to beat a dead horse, but I think it comes back to kind of the ability, you know, for the folks in presidential personnel, you need people with really strong diplomacy skills who can build those relationships effectively kind of from the very beginning.
Let me ask you about a couple other agencies that you will know the acronyms, but many of our listeners won't. So OGE, Office of Government Ethics, what do they do and how does the Presidential Personnel Office work with OGE? Jonathan?
There's actually a third, which is there's also ethics officers in each agency. So there are three different groups that look at the ethics of a candidate, particularly when they're going through a Senate confirmed job, but can be others as well. And they're looking at three different potential set of conflicts. OGE, which is a part of the White House, is looking at core conflicts as the White House entities, things you own, relationships you have, whatever the case may be, that might run afoul or look to be running afoul of something that is a White House interest. The personnel office is looking at relevant to the president's interests, which really have to do with policy, but also can be optic as well. Is there something about you that would run afoul of something that was important to the president? And then the agency's a third standard, which is there are things going on in agencies all the time. There are disputes, legal cases, things like that. They have to look at each candidate and say, okay, even if the White House and the president are fine with this person, if they come over here, do they create some kind of ethical conflict that is unique to the role that they have in working in this agency? So there are three groups. It was a very well-oiled machine. Everybody worked really, really well together in the agency and in the White House, OGE. These were people who had done these jobs for a long time and were real subject matter experts, took their job extremely seriously and apolitically.
So let's talk about the differences between a first term or a second term. So let's start with Donald Trump getting reelected. So I was looking back at the numbers. And in fact, the two chiefs of staff that you work with, Josh Bolton and Dennis McDonough, they were on Transition Lab. And we kind of had a debate about the right level of turnover second term. So Bush, if you take the secretaries, deputy secretaries, and undersecretaries, so the top three level positions, 54% of those people left the government within 6 months of Bush's second term, this George W. Bush. And in the Obama administration, 34% left. So it's much lower. Dennis argued we had better retention, we had more stability, that was positive. Josh argued, actually, you want fresh eyes, fresh legs, fresh energy, because people are tired and you need rejuvenation in the second term. So, Liza, how did you approach personnel at the start of the second term, and what did you do in year four to get ready for year five?
Yeah, I know it's a great question. And I agree with Josh wholeheartedly. I mean, I remember before the 2004 election, getting called into the Oval Office, and President Bush and I had a conversation, and I think back then it was Andy Card, about 8 or 9 cabinet members that we were going to be replacing. That's a lot. And so our office, you know, 2 months before that election, basically ramped up like a kind of a transition effort, if you will, and basically had our lists and kind of ready to go so that right after the election, we could kind of make those announcements to announce who those cabinet members were going to be. So what we did is really treated it as a big transition and really identified ahead of time, you know, made lists of who were, you know, people probable that we would lose. In fact, what we did is we identified kind of a stoplight system, you know, a red, yellow, and green light system, where we went through all of the Senate confirmed positions across
100% of them across the government.
Yes.
Or the top ones, basically.
Yes, the top ones. And we identified if it was, you know, if someone was a red, we knew they were leaving, you know, or we knew we wanted to, you know, have them leave. If they were yellow, we were at risk of losing them. And if they were green, then we knew that, you know, we felt comfortable that we wouldn't have to replace them. And then that helped us prioritize who, you know, what my team could focus on, because we just, we're trying to implement that to be more proactive and to cut down the time it was going to take to bring new people into the administration. So that's kind of how we handled it.
Jonathan, you were there for the reelect in year five. How did you approach it in year four for year five?
It was similar, actually. So we did a lot of preparation going into the election year. We started bringing senior appointees back to the White House quite a bit in an effort to retain them, because you want to keep people there working while this campaign is going on, but they're obviously concerned about winning reelection. But we also, we built off what the Bush team had done, and we actually had started doing succession planning quarterly with each cabinet secretary a couple of years earlier, where we would have that same conversation about how likely is this person to stay, over what period of time, should they be promoted to another role in the agency or across the administration. We started having those conversations about every single person a couple of years earlier, and the whole point was to have a sense of where people were going to be and where there were opportunities to keep people around, right? So they might have changed jobs, but they stayed in the administration, so they stayed longer. And that's what Dennis was referring to. We worked very hard to try to smooth out the outflows and to give really good people a chance to keep working, because they had learned a lot in their first 18-month, 24-month cycle, and so we wanted to keep them around. So that might have contributed to a smoother, kind of even set of outflows, but I can't tell you that for sure. I just know that that was something we started working on in the second year and got pretty good at by that point. And so we're able to kind of predict a little bit better and then preempt and try to keep people around.
Got it. So the Wall Street Journal has reported that Chris Liddell, who's the deputy chief of staff and ran the Romney transition, very competent guy, is running this process for Trump. And you would say the best practice is to look at across the entire government, all the presidentially appointed Senate confirmed positions, and do a talent assessment. Who do you want to stick around? Who do you want to change? And then how do you strengthen your team for the second term?
I would add one thing to that. Go to them and talk to them and say, hey, we've got plans for you, or we want to make sure, or start having a dialogue with them about their plans and getting close to them. Because they're leaving makes
And you did me- that pre-elect, Jonathan? You would actually talk to them pre-election or just post-election?
We start the succession planning gave us the information to be able to start doing that as a little bit of a habit. But when we went into the reelection year, we started doing a lot more of it. And again, bringing people to the White House to remind them of why they were there so they could kind of spend more time with the president directly and with senior staff. But we tried to be more proactive in saying to people, hey, you know, if you want to stay, we have plans for you. Because since people would make news if they left or whatever, you usually found out they were leaving when they had decided. In many cases. And so if you could start having the conversation early, present alternatives, move them when they're kind of still engaged, you have a better shot.
Okay, let's go to the scenario with Vice President Biden wins. So if he wins, he has to appoint 4,000 people, 1,250 of them need to be confirmed by the Senate. It's a very slow process. So Obama had the fastest launch, and of the 1,250 Senate confirmed positions, he only had 69 in at day 100, 69. And that's the best ever. It takes a long time. So what would your advice be to the Biden team about creating a presidential personnel office that has capacity to handle a high velocity of appointments? Liza, do you want to start?
Well, my advice would be that, I mean, essentially they've got to already be well underway with their efforts. You almost have to work backwards, right? Because the election happens. If Biden gets elected, he needs to be in a position where he's ready to make announcements for all the key top, you know, kind of cabinet posts and any other kind of key positions. And so to do that, you know, it takes a lot of time and a lot of kind of work on the transition. And so I think right now they've got to have those lists developed. I think the longer lead time they have and the more that's being, you know, kind of almost baked before the election, the better off they're going to be able to launch very quickly.
And Jonathan, let me pinpoint this directly. So if Biden were to win, let's assume he has a good transition, they have all the plans in place. What do they need to do to have an effective PPO on day one to handle a high velocity of appointments?
They have to start now. So they have to start building in the capability and the conversations and the meeting regularly as they're just as they're building policy teams, right, to work on different policies. They should be thinking, okay, as we've made decisions around different policies, who are the types of people first? And then if I have a prototype, then where might those people be and start identifying folks? There's also something which I think, I don't know if it's been done in the past or not, but they're also going to enter into or would be entering into agencies where there are a lot of actings. Right. And these are career civil servants who've been acting in these roles for some time. Having the teams that do the work on the different agencies during the transition, identifying which of those people are helpful and are doing things that are like helpful and can actually stay in longer, which allows them to focus more on the higher need areas as opposed to having to do it all at once, is something we're at least to look at. I can't say for sure that that's a viable strategy because we didn't have a chance to do it, but it's definitely worth looking at because, as you were saying, there's so many positions at once that you're trying to get through. If there's certain parts that are running well and are consistent with your theory, it's better if you can keep them running.
Right. Got it. That's good advice. Let me ask you this. So you've gone on from PPO to have continuing successful careers in the private sector. One of the things you've presumably been involved in that I was involved in my private sector career was talent management. And this is something the Partnership for Public Service has been pushing for a long time, which is for PPO and the government to really focus not just on appointments, but also effective talent management. So do you have any advice for a future PPO director in terms of how to include talent management and development of personnel as a priority along with just appointments? Liza?
Yeah, I think it's a really critical step because when you think about talent management, you know, talent acquisition is a part of that, right? You got to find the people, but then it's onboarding them and engaging them appropriately and in a productive way. It's developing them as they get their sea legs and they understand what their jobs are. It's, you know, it's performance management, it's succession planning, it's all of these things in combination, in concert. But to do that, Dave, it's going to require an investment it is such a huge job to just onboard these people and to, you know, find these people that with the numbers of people in presidential personnel that they have, they can't possibly add on all of those other areas, I think. I think there's got to be some thoughtful approach and working maybe in partnership with the White House liaisons at all the offices to really identify who are the high performers. I mean, we really tried to do that and identify people and then look at, okay, what's their highest and best use and sometimes take them from the Treasury Department and put them over at, you know, another department. I think that a little bit more kind of, I would advise any future administration to actually have people focused on that because we were spread so thin. We weren't able to do that, I think, as effectively as I would have liked.
Got it. And Jonathan, you and I both spent, and I know Liza's worked on this as well, a lot of time working on diversity in our private sector careers. I was chairman of the Twigo Foundation and you were actively involved. And then you led diversity inclusion at one of the largest financial institution in the world, BlackRock. So how did you approach the issue of diversity when you were head of presidential personnel? And what would you advise that a future head of presidential personnel could do better or learn from some of the problems or mistakes that you made or encountered?
So a couple of things. The first is, you know, establishing with the president-elect what their belief system is around this and making that clear to people as they're coming through the process as candidates in senior positions about what the aspirations are around diversity, what types of things matter, how you want to approach it. But also we learned that, you know, having those successful funding conversations and having a agency by agency high level conversation allowed us to talk about diversity across 200 or 300 positions over time, not one by one. And that makes it a lot easier to sit and say, how do we want to put the best team in place representing the entire country that it's supposed to represent? Well, you need a year and you need lots of positions and you need lots of opportunities and you need to be able to be strategic about it like anything else. And so planning at that level, having a regular quarterly discussion to keep see how you're doing and keeping on pace is a great way to have that conversation. And the one thing I'll just say about why this matters is because there are a bunch of reasons why diversity matters. But one of the things that's in particular is that you have a lot of people on the outside who are looking at this government to represent them. And they want to make gives them great confidence to see people there who seem to get them better. And we have a pretty broad country to represent. And we have not so many positions considering that we need to fill. You have to be strategic and you have to start from day one.
And did you focus on diversity mostly from a gender and race perspective, or did you also look at geography, age, a much broader set of criteria?
We looked at it across the board. So it was, you know, ethnic and racial diversity and everything you just said, geographic diversity. We also looked at making sure we're bringing in people that kind of represent different types of backgrounds. So people out of corporate America, varied industry backgrounds, people out of, you know, the nonprofit sector, international NGOs, you know, higher ed, you know, to really have gender, certainly diversity as well. So I think it was, to us, diversity kind of encompassed a really broad, we took a broad view of it.
Right. That's great. So for every person that you made happy in terms of saying you got this job, how many people did you have to make unhappy? Was it 10? Was it 20? Was it 50?
A lot.
A lot. Yeah.
It depended, right, Jonathan? I mean, it just kind of depended on the position. I would say on average, probably, you know, 20.
20. Okay.
Maybe more.
So recognizing that it's a brutal job, that you had 500 phone calls a day, that you disappointed 19 people for every person you made happy, what are you most proud of in this important job and your distinguished government service? Liza, will you start?
Absolutely. First of all, it was such an honor to serve. So I felt like it was the, you know, I always said this will always be the greatest honor and highlight of my career, no matter what I do going forward. What I'm most proud of is it's funny. I think my proudest moment came like 6 months after I left the administration, which sounds a bit odd. Back in the Bush days, like we were constantly getting, you know, the Washington Post, all the press, constantly getting kind of just beaten up in the media as it relates to the personnel process about, you know, cronyism and, you know, stuff like that. And what I remember reading an article, it was like in the spring of 2008. And it was an article in the Post that talked about the second term team and how strong and the competency of the, you know, how incredible Bush's second term team was. And I remember thinking that it was a very quiet, proud moment. I still have that article because it was kind of the pinnacle of so much work behind the scenes, to really, you know, to get there. So,
yeah. And thank God that President Bush appointed someone like Hank Paulson,
yeah,
you know, Ben Bernanke, Tim Geithner, because they were there at a critical time for the country.
You know, working with so many people was great, but Hank Paulson during that time, it was such a consequential time, and he was just fantastic to work with, and was such a strong partner with everybody in the White House. So that was probably one of the highlights for me, for sure.
How about you, Jonathan? What are you most proud of?
I'm going to cheat and give you three answers really quickly.
Okay.
First is we finished up 8-year data being the most diverse administration in history, but also, as we talked about earlier, we actually retained people at higher rates with lower turnover, but also they're more productive after the first year. So if you can keep them longer, their output is more, they're doing more for the American people with each seat. But also we, over the 8 years, I think, I don't know how to measure this, but I think it's true to say that we had far fewer public personnel issues and were able to really focus much more on the business at hand. Now, we also had a very rigorous process that's famous that might have slowed some things down. But we were able to go through the 8 years without a lot of hiccups and kind of personnel-related fights in the media around ethics and other things that end up becoming distractions.
Right. Well, thank you for both of your time, your wisdom, and most importantly, thank you for serving our country at such a critical time. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Dave.
Thanks.
If you like Transition Lab, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, and give a review on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app.